Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to get underway here. My name is Leslie Killen, and I'm the executive director for the Center for Documentary Expression and Art. And it's my pleasure to start out by introducing our sponsors today, the Interreligious Engagement Initiative at Utah Valley University, the Utah Humanities Council, and the Salt Lake City Public Library. And last but not least, the Center for Documentary Expression and Art. It's an honor for me to be here with you this afternoon on the 10th anniversary of September 11, and I guess the final day of this conference on pluralism, to introduce Dr. Charles Payne. Dr. Payne is the Frank P. Hickson Professor in the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago. His interests are broad and deep and include urban education, school reform, social inequality, social change, and modern African American history. His most recent books are, one of them is I Saw Out There, So Much Reform, So Little Change, which examines the persistence of failure in urban schools, and an anthology, Teach Freedom, the African American Tradition of Education for Liberation. He's also the author of I've Got the Light of Freedom, The Organizing Tradition in the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. The latter book won awards from the Southern Regional Council, Choice Magazine, the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, the Gustavus Meyer Center for the Study of Human Rights in North America. With the support of the Carnegie Scholars Program, Dr. Payne is now doing a study of how school reform dialogue in other countries compares to the American situation. And with the support of the Alphonse Fletcher Senior Fellowship, he's also conducting a study of the most productive urban school districts. Fletcher Fellowships support work that contributes to improving race relations in American society and furthers the broad social goals of the U.S. Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision of 1954. Dr. Payne has been a member of a number of boards, too many for me to list here entirely, but including the Board of Chicago Algebra Project, the Steering Committee for the Consortium on Chicano School Research, on Chicago School Research. He currently serves on the Advisory Board for Teacher College Press's series on social justice and the Research Committee for the Public Education Fund in Chicago. He's also a co-founder of the Duke Curriculum Project, which involves university faculty in the professional development of public school teachers, and is also a co-founder of the John Hope Franklin Scholars, which tries to better prepare high school youngsters for college. And he is among the founders of Education for Liberation Network, which encourages the development of educational initiatives that encourage young people to think critically about social issues and to understand their own capacity for addressing them. Please, let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Charles Payne.
I want to thank Leslie for that very kind, even if overlong, introduction. I also want to thank Safi and the other members of the library's leadership for making my presence in Salt Lake City possible here today. And of course, I mean, it is the 10th anniversary of 9/11. It's hard for me to think of a more appropriate memorial for that tragedy than the kind of symposium the library has been sponsoring, the library and the other sponsors have been supporting here for this week. But I did hear much of the previous panel, and much that Mr. Zamora said in particular resonates with me. And I just want to say that I want to underscore that I agree with him that discussions of tolerance, that's a word I have no use for, actually. Diversity, I have very, very little use for, right? Sensitivity, those conversations, when they are separated from conversations about distributions of power and privilege, I find to be not only useless but counterproductive. They actually reinforce the problems that they are supposed to be trying to address. When we think about 9/11, one of the things we can be absolutely certain of is that the kind of hatred which both drove that event and the other hatreds which resulted from that event are both predicated on a certain kind of social denial. It is much easier to kill innocents when we deny the real and symbolic connections between themselves and ourselves, when we put them into another category of human worth. The problem of not losing touch with what we have in common, our differences notwithstanding, is arguably the single most important problem in the issue of pluralism and how we maintain plural societies. By definition, the denial of interconnection is a part of racism. We should certainly not be surprised that the way in which we understand the past, the way in which we understand history, is also affected by these tendencies to minimize the connections and interconnections among our particular stories. We balkanize our memory in the same way we balkanize our contemporary lives. I have studied for almost too much of my adult life the civil rights movement, and if there's one thing that is certain about the way in which we remember the movement, it is that the way in which most Americans remember the movement bears only a glancing resemblance to the way in which participants in the movement remember the movement. And that, as our last panel sort of implied, that doesn't have to be the gospel truth either, right? But it does imply that the perspectives that most of us look back on the movement with are not the only perspectives which are operated. And my point is, can be in part, that what we are doing in the way in which we have constructed memories of the civil rights movement is ghettoizing the history. We tend to see the civil rights movement as a movement about whom? It's a movement about black people, or about Negroes, as we were at the time. A movement about black people and black people only. Now, was it this spring that the U.S. women's soccer team made that magnificent run, right, on the world stage? I was wondering all the time that was going on, how many people thought about the connection between the U.S. women's soccer team and the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And I'm fairly confident that not a whole lot of people had that on the forefront of their mind as you're wondering who's going to come away with the gold, right? But take Title IX, which required equal funding across genders for intercollegiate athletics. Take Title IX out of the Civil Rights Act. Take away the enormous growth of women's athletics at the collegiate level, which it made possible. It's impossible to see how we could have gotten to where the U.S. women's soccer team is now, right? But those connections, which are quite obvious and easy to make, have pretty much been pushed to the background of our thinking. And so in that spirit, I'm going to try to make 3 points this afternoon. The first I've already stated. We fail to see the movement whole. We fail to see its interconnections with our lives. We ghettoize this history as a history that affects only and primarily black people. In fact, it's not at all clear to me that the largest beneficiaries of what we call the civil rights movement were black people. That's an arguable proposition. Second point I want to make is that the movement had the broad impact it had because, again, and this has become a forgotten part of history, it had the broad impact it had because much of the movement practiced a deliberate, self-conscious politics of empowerment, a politics of individual growth. Lastly, I want to suggest that I think there's a relationship between that kind of politics of empowerment and something I think you have been talking about all week, the ethical capacity of societies, right? People who don't think they matter may do almost anything at all, right, with all kinds of negative ethical consequences. So let me start by saying something about the catalytic role of the movement. This is a test. I want to see hands. I want to see the hands of everyone who more or less knows the context for this for the sentence from a famous speech. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. May I see the hands? You don't count, you're too old. There was a time when that sentence would have been read, would have been recognized by virtually every American college student. And doggone there, everybody who identified with a student left, which was a large proportion of that. Let me read you the whole paragraph. December 1965. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus. And you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. That was Mario Savio on the steps of Sproul Hall at Berkeley University in December 1964, right? That speech is one of the most iconic speeches of the New Left. It has the kind of, think of it as the parallel in that world to I Have a Dream in the civil rights world, to that speech, right? The Berkeley Free Speech Movement, of which Savio was a leader, then becomes the catalyst which starts student power movements at universities all across the country. And at Berkeley and elsewhere, a great many of those students saw their fight for student rights as an extension of the civil rights fight. But the reason that I'm starting there is because Savio gave that speech in December 64. In August 64, he was in Holmes County, Mississippi, as working on what came to be known as the Freedom Summer Project, working to obtain the right to vote for black people, right? And there's a clear connection between what he was doing in August and what he was doing in December. I will come back to that. If you want to talk, though, about the relationship between the civil rights movement and the New Left, we could go back even further to the founding of SDS in 1962, February, I think, and I think its 50th anniversary will be coming up this year. The emphasis, the political emphasis, one of the defining political emphases of SDS was participatory democracy, was the idea that every person has a right to have some input in the decisions which affect that person's life. Representative democracy is not enough, right? SDS very clearly got that idea from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which is the organization, mostly young black people, though certainly integrated before it was over, that grew out of the civil rights sit-ins and was deeply affected by Ella Baker, a person about whom I'll say a few words in a couple of minutes. More broadly than the point about participatory democracy, SDS's entire conception of what it meant to be an activist was largely based on how they understood what SNCC was doing in the Deep South at the time. There are all kinds of articles written in which SDS folk go down to Mississippi or Alabama and write back about what the SNCC people are doing and how SDS needs to emulate that. If you were to look at one of the other defining movements of that decade of the 60s, the anti-war movement, you again find its leadership is just heavily salted with civil rights veterans. I'm pretty sure it's right to say, I just thought of this afternoon and didn't get a chance to check it, but I'm pretty sure the first significant tactical innovation of the anti-Vietnam War movement was the teach-in. The teach-in meant, in some cases, you stopped all classes on a campus, or as many as you could, and you had consciousness-raising sessions in which you were telling people the truth, as that group understood it, about what this country was doing in Vietnam. The first of the teach-ins happened at the University of Michigan. They happened in the spring of 1965. It is no accident. I referred a moment ago to Freedom Summer, to all of the students, overwhelmingly white, who went to Mississippi to work for that summer. It's no accident that the University of Michigan, I started to say the University of Mississippi had sent one of the largest contingents. That would have been a different history. Right? The University of Michigan had sent one of the largest contingents of student volunteers. When those people came back and they began to think about how to organize against the war, it was only natural that they took some of their ideas from the experiences they had in the civil rights movement. And so the idea of the teach-in comes directly from something civil rights movements had been doing, the freedom schools, which were intended to raise the consciousness of black students and black adults about the conditions that black people found themselves in. So again, that major tactical innovation, which then is going to, over the next year, it's going to sweep the country. Every significant university I know of has its teach-ins about Vietnam and begins to build the constituency, which is going to become the basis for the war protest. It is those Freedom Summer volunteers at the University of Michigan who started that, again drawing on their civil rights experience. There is an ongoing debate in the case of feminism, whether the civil rights movement should be thought of as the mother or the stepmother of feminism, right? And I will not try to go through the debate here. My actual answer is I think it's both, all right? But you'll hear something about this. It's a complicated history, but I can give you one sense of how important it was by quoting from another of the foundational documents of that, a kind of memo, which was written by two white women who were in the civil rights movement in 1965. You have to remember, in 1965, we don't have the term sexism. We don't have the term chauvinism, right? There may have been very, very small groups using that kind of language, but in 1965, we do not have a commonly accepted language, even among leftists, among activists, to talk about gender inequality. And what they are doing in this essay, from which I'm about to quote, is sort of fumbling toward that language, right? But let me indulge myself. This is Sex and Caste, a kind of memo from Casey Hayden and Mary King to another of other women in the peace and freedom movements. And notice how they put all that together, right? They make us one big movement, peace and freedom. We've talked a lot to each other and to some of you about your own and other women's problems in trying to live our personal lives and in our work as independent and creative people. In these conversations, we found what seemed to be recurrent ideas or themes. Maybe we can look at these things many of us perceive often as a result of insights learned from the movement, meaning the civil rights movement. Sex and caste. There seem to be many parallels that can be drawn between treatment of Negroes and treatment of women in our society as a whole. But in particular, men we've talked to who work in the movement seem to be caught up in a common law caste system that operates, forcing them to work around or outside hierarchical structures of power which may exclude them, right? It is a caste system which, at its worst, uses and exploits women. The caste system perspective dictates the roles assigned to women. Within the movement, questions arise as to who cleans the Freedom House, to who holds leadership position, to who does secretarial work, and to who acts as spokesmen for the groups. All right. Men's reactions to the questions raised here. At the same time, very few men, they're talking about some of the most best educated and most progressive men in the country, the men who are in these movements, right? At the same time, very few men can respond non-defensively, since the whole idea is either beyond their comprehension or threatens and exposes them. The usual response is laughter. I will admit, when I was a sophomore or junior at Syracuse University, let us say 67 or 68, and a white woman said to me something along the lines of, well, after all, Negroes and women are in the same boat, aren't they? I didn't have a negative reaction. It was literally incomprehension. I did not understand what she was trying to say, right? I mean, that notion was just so far outside of my experience. And then finally, I just have to say this. There's a lack of community for discussion. Nobody is writing or organizing or talking publicly about women in any way that reflects the problems that various women in the movement come across and which we've tried to touch above. Objectively, the chances seem nil that we could start a movement based on anything as distant to general American thought as a sex caste system. We can't start a movement based on this idea. That's 1965, right? By 1967, the country is going to be embroiled in this whole notion of feminism, right? 2 years after they said it wasn't possible, we would be up to our necks in trying to figure out what this movement was about, right? And the movement would obviously be changing American society in fundamental ways forever. What happens to this memo, which they just sent out to a few of their friends, who sent it out to a few of their friends, who sent it out to a few of their friends, that it was circulated across the so-called peace and freedom movements. It's one of those times when a couple of people come up with the language to express what other people are thinking but didn't know how to say, right? Or other people were feeling and didn't feel it was legitimate enough, it wasn't political enough, it was too personal to raise in these contexts. It was like throwing a match into a can of gasoline. There were certainly other documents that were very important, but for women in the New Left, who were going to form a disproportionate part of the leadership of that wave of feminism, this essay becomes iconic. It becomes crucial. And again, it grows out of experiences, some of them quite negative experiences, in the civil rights movement. So, I mean, that's probably enough to make my first point. There's no question that the civil rights movement ushers in a decade of mass-based, confrontational, direct-action politics. Dick Gregory has this thing. I actually tried to find it so I could play it for you, because I can't do Dick Gregory, right? But the point is, he says, listen, every time you walk into an airplane and you see a fat, balding, male, middle-aged flight attendant, you should walk up to that man and ask that man if he has thanked the civil rights activist for his job, right? Because 40 years ago, you had to be young and female and good-looking to have those jobs. And what the movement did is to usher in a culture of equality, in Dick Gregory's language, that made it possible for people to challenge those kinds of restrictions on who could do what, right? And in that culture of equality, it became easier for a whole lot of other stigmatized and marginalized groups to raise the issues that they needed to raise, right? If you sort of step out of the whole issue of other movements, I think one of the things that I have heard virtually no commentary on from Southern white intellectual leaders is the impact the positive impacts that movement had on the white South, which was always, for good reason, the poorest part of this country. What has happened since the 60s, in between the 60s and now, is that we had this economic revolution in the Sun Belt. It is very, very clear that the states of the old Confederacy would not have profited from that movement of American industry out of the North and East and the Central states into the South and Southwestern states if they were still living by lynch law and Jim Crow societies, right? Toyota is not going to put multi-million-dollar plants in Tennessee when Tennessee is not allowing black people to vote, right? As much of the leadership of Southern states fought against it, in economic terms, I think you have to conclude that some of the major beneficiaries of the civil rights movement are Southern whites. And I haven't looked up statistics in a couple of years, but the last times I did, the constituency on behalf of whom the Office of Civil Rights had filed the most anti-discrimination suits were white women, right? And so again, the idea of thinking about the civil rights movement as a movement that did something good for black people denies the interconnections between that history and our own lives, right, in some very important ways. Some of you know Bernice Honey, because I know some of you know Sweet Honey in the Rock, you know, and she's the founder of Sweet Honey in the Rock. In 1962, she's a young, headstrong high school student in Albany, Georgia. She gets swept up in the movement. And she has an article, it's actually called The Borning Struggle, in which she makes the point I just made, that to some degree, the civil rights movement is the Borning Struggle of the 60s, right? The other movements are born out of it. That's a little strong, but you know, I think it's close enough for right now. But in that article, she makes another point that's pertinent to my second point. She argues that all of the histories of the movement that talk about the Kennedy brothers and what they did or did not do, what they did or did not believe, that talk about Dr. King and what he did or did not do, all the histories of the movement that talk about the Civil Rights Act of 64 or the Civil Rights Act of 65, all the histories of the movement which talk about Selma or the March on Washington or Birmingham or the big demonstration, every single one of them misses the entire point of the movement as she lived it. That none of that stuff touches on what is most central about movement history for her. And she says that central point is that having been a participant in the movement gave her the power to step across any line that anybody tried to draw around her. Right? It was that confidence that she could control her life that mattered, not the tactical stuff. Those things, she says, history will sweep that away. But forever, I'm going to be shaped by what the movement did for me. That transformative power of the movement is a large part of what made the other stuff I talked about possible. It was possible for the movement to develop cadres of leaders for other movements precisely because people grew so much in the context of this movement. Mario Savio, who became this great leader at Berkeley, a nationally recognized figure, much respected for his eloquence. We have comments about him from his friends the spring before he goes to 64. You can find them in a book called Freedom Summer by Doug McAdam, right? Before he goes to Mississippi, he's described as shy, unassuming, and retiring. You get no sense of a man who is going to lead what's going to become a nationally important movement. In his own mind, it was Mississippi, Savio's own mind, it was Mississippi that transformed him, that gave him a kind of credential, to use an important word here, that gave him a kind of credential to think that he could be a leader in other kinds of movements. Let me quote one other passage from that Hayden and King essay. They alluded to this earlier, but I want to be very explicit. Having learned from the movement to think radically about the personal worth and abilities of people whose role in society had gone unchallenged before, they mean black people, a lot of women in the movement have begun trying to apply those lessons to their own relationships with men, right? So when you think deeply about the black-white relationship, and that gives you a whole set of questions about the male-female relationship. Sarah Evans from the University of Minnesota, who's written extensively about this, argues that one of the other formative influences on some of the white women who went south in the civil rights movement was the older black women that they met, women who were sources of strength, of confidence, who played a public role in politics that they, coming from their backgrounds, those students, had not been accustomed to. You could not spend a lot of time around Ella Baker or Fannie Lou Hamer and not be affected by it, and specifically not to question restrictions on your role as a woman. Since I just mentioned Ella Baker, let me say a few more words about Ms. Baker. Can I just say again, a show of hands, of curiosity, but for those of you who recognize that name, that's actually quite impressive. Some of you are clearly either activists or teachers, right? That's sort of her constituency. The explicit focus on leadership development in some civil rights organizations, SNCC and CORE, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Congress of Racial Equality, particularly those two, is shaped by a number of factors, but you could argue that Ella Baker is the most important. Vincent Harding, whom I consider the dean of civil rights historian, has a speech that is entitled Malcolm, Martin, and Ella, right? And the thesis of the speech is that Ella was as important as Malcolm or Martin, right? Which to most people seemed absurd. It's actually a very defensible proposition for a whole bunch of reasons. She is a non-historical. Some of this does have to do with gender and how we can conceive of gender in the past. And when people are looking for leadership, they're not looking for a short black woman with funny hats, right? Some of it is that. Some of it has to do with some choices that she made herself. I won't go into that. Let me just say that the short version of Ella Baker is that for a period of 50 years from the 1950s through the 1970s, wherever the black movement is, she is at the cutting edge of it. In the 1940s, because I know we have NAACP leadership here, when the NAACP League goes through the greatest growth in its membership that it ever went to, don't trust my memory, but something like a membership of 200,000 to a membership of 500,000. She's the director of membership when that's happening, right? She's able to do that because even before she did that, she had spent significant time doing grassroots organizing in the South. She had an incredible network of activists in the South. She worked for CORE when CORE was leading direct action campaigns in New York City. When Martin Luther King comes to national prominence in Montgomery, among older activists, there is a great deal of concern that somebody as young as he is, I want to say he was 26, he was green, and all of a sudden everybody's throwing a microphone in his face, right? He's never created an organization. He's been handed a church. That's not the same thing as creating a mass movement, right? A group of activists convinced Ella Baker to go down south, to go to Montgomery, and to become his first. The first acting executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She was the person to give organizational reality, organizational coherence to the ideas and work of Dr. King. She was certainly one of them. Then, in that position, she goes on to do what I think she would define as her certainly one of the achievements of her lifetime, one of the feathers in her cap, right? She more or less guides the formation of SNCC out of the sit-ins. She doesn't let the adult, when the sit-ins start, all the old adult organizations want to take over all this youthful energy, and she sort of says, no, the kids ought to have their own organizations because you old people will just mess them up, right? And then, of course, she breathes into SNCC this distinctive philosophy that around leadership being, I shouldn't say that, around the idea that we value too much top-down leadership and we undervalue the importance of bottom-up leadership. That if she recognized that both were necessary and that long-term social movements need all kinds of leadership, but that we tend to see one kind and value one kind and not see and value the others. Let me give you a few of her quotes and you will recognize the context for the first one. I have always felt it was a handicap for oppressed people to depend so largely on a leader. Because unfortunately in our culture, the charismatic leader usually becomes a leader because he has found a spot in the public limelight. It usually means that the media made him, I'm sorry, and the media may undo him. There is also the danger in our culture that because a person is called upon to give public statements and is acclaimed by the establishment, such a person gets to the point of believing that he is the movement. Such people get so involved with playing the game of being important that they exhaust themselves and their time, and they don't do the work of actually organizing people. Now, if you listen to that closely, you might infer that there were, you might infer that there was some significant tensions between her and Dr. King. That would be true. But I also know her life well enough to say she would have said the same thing about people she worked with in the 1930s and 1940s. I mean, her critique of the Southern black minister as a political type would have been exactly the critique that you heard in there. So it's not, she and King did go like this. She always said she knew that there would never be a long-term role for her inside SCLC, partly because she was a woman. And that's a strongly chauvinistic culture. The ideas have to do with her general attitude toward top-down leadership, not just the particular expression of it, that the young Dr. King, because Dr. King changes over time, right? The older Dr. King would have agreed with some of what she said about the younger Dr. King. Anyway, that was one quote from her. Here are a couple of others. The defining quote for this afternoon, my friends, strong people don't need strong leaders. My basic sense of it has always been to get people to understand that in the long run, they themselves are the only protection they have against violence or injustice. I thought of this quote in the previous panel when there was a question about, will the Arab Spring, and I'm not saying this well, but will the Arab Spring lead to other forms of dictatorship, right? And I think from Ella Baker's point is, the viewpoint is to the degree that you trust your leaders, you can be certain that it will, right? To the degree that you can always expect that the leadership will turn out to have feet of clay in one form or another sooner or later. It is only to the degree that you have a genuinely broad-based leadership that you can have people who can challenge the leadership from the excesses that it's like that leadership is likely to engage in. So anyway, my basic sense has always been that people have to understand that they themselves are the only protection they have against violence or injustice. People have to be made to understand that they cannot look for salvation anywhere but to themselves. I have always thought that what is needed, and this is what SNCC tried to breathe into life, is the development of people who are interested not in being leaders as much as in developing leadership in others, right? Don't be the leader, develop leadership in others, right? There's a critique from a poem, I've forgotten who wrote it, but it was about Dr. King, for whom, despite what I'm framing him in this conversation, I have unbounded admiration. But the quote was, he left the people who had no way of fighting but following, right? And that would have expressed the kind of feeling of Ella Baker. When SNCC goes into Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana towns in 1961 and 1962, and they try to, out Georgia, do not leave off Georgia, and they try to act out in what Ella Baker has taught them. What does that look like, right? Well, that would be a whole other lecture, but just let me give you one last quote, right? This is from Bob Moses, and again, if you know Ella Baker, you probably know Bob Moses, right? They're sort of joined in the historical discussion. He would not mind being called one of her disciples, right? There was a really great, intelligent interviewer was interviewing Bob Moses. It happened to be me, as a matter of fact. And so the interviewer asked Bob Moses, when you think about empowering leadership at the grassroots level, do particular examples come to mind? And he says, Mrs. Palmer. And being lightning fast, I say, Mrs. Palmer? And he says, yes, Hazel Palmer. She really came to symbolize for me this kind of empowerment of the grassroots people, this leadership phenomena that Ella Baker pointed us to. She never became a media person, right? She always worked behind the scenes in the Freedom Democratic Party. She had been the janitor at one of the local schools, and then her children got involved in the Freedom Rides in 61. She began to work with Medgar Evers, and then when Medgar was assassinated in 63, she came over to the COFO office, Council of Federated Organizations, the Coalition of Civil Rights Organizations, and started working with us. Then she got involved in the Freedom Democratic Party and became sort of the chief networking person out of the Jackson office. So she would really do a lot of the calling and networking with groups around the country and really became very sophisticated. This woman who had been doing domestic work had become very sophisticated in her understanding of the movement and the organizing, what the movement was trying to do with poor people like her. Remember, it was Mr. Zamora, I believe, in the last panel, who I thought was kind of making a joke that the audience didn't get, by the way, about him not having the credentials to speak to us this afternoon, right? Well, in the way that he was using the credentials, that's the way that Bob Moses is going to be using credentials when he talks about her. She says that after the movement, there was because she had no credentials, she couldn't get the kind of job and work that other folk who had credentials in the movement. So she went back to Jackson, Mississippi, running a washateria. She didn't have the sort of credentials, academic credentials or otherwise, to move into the professional world. So Mrs. Palmer, I used to go around and talk about her because she really came to represent what we were trying to do in the organizing. There was a dimension to it which is dealing with this transformation of people. That's the phrase I wanted to get to, the transformation of people. Outside of the institutions which are normally credentializing people, universities, labor unions, and sort of giving the kind of support which allows them to feel, well, I can really feel this role. I can really play this role. And the movement does play that role, that transforming role, that credentializing role for poor people. Let me go off on a slight tangent that is also occasioned by the previous panel. I believe I understood a panelist to say something like, when you're doing really important work and you know that it's important work, you don't feel the stress, right? Now, if I understood that right, that is dramatically at odds with how I understand this history, right? I've just said that for a lot of people, and I've talked to, I will say, quite a few folk from the movement about their own growth and how it transformed them and how it was the best thing in their lives, right? Some of those same people will say I was daggone near destroyed by this thing, right? You had people who at the age of 22 and 23 had ulcers, right? You had people who had to drop out for various periods of time, not just from the movement, but from virtually everything else, right? They simply withdrew into themselves. There was that much tension in their lives. At the SNCC 50th reunion in April, this April past, one of the old, if that woman heard me calling her old, she slapped my, one of the veteran SNCC organizers got to talking about what they would do differently if they had a chance to do it again. One of them, by the way, was to convey a different sense of what they had done to the following generations. But the one that's on they think that they bear a certain kind of responsibility for the lack of political understanding of young people today because they stopped trying to control their image. That's one point. But the point that she was making that drew a standing ovation from the activists, that if we had to do it over, we would take better care of our own mental health, right? These were people who, after 2 or 3 years in the field, right, were deeply stressed out in ways that had all kinds of ramifications for their lives. Let me just quickly say something about the final point that I wanted to make. I think it's clear that we don't know as much as we should, I think, about how these transformative processes take place, but we know something about how it takes place. The last point I want to make is that the kind of self-empowerment that Bob Moses is talking about, that Ella Baker talked about, can be an important component in supporting the capacity for ethical behavior in individuals or societies. And this will take us back to the idea that, again from the previous panel, professors and gangbangers are not necessarily all that different, right? I take that to literally be the case, and I know a few of both of them, right? I have a friend, Bob Jackal, a sociologist, who spent a considerable time when he was younger studying people who make completely morally reprehensible decisions, right? Toyota, a couple years ago, was selling brakes when its executives knew that those brakes could stick, right? And they decided, once they knew about the problem, they decided to stonewall that problem, is my understanding. Again, a few years ago in West Virginia, we had that horrendous loss of life in a mine explosion. Well, it seemed to be pretty clear that the operators of the mine knew that they were allowing methane and coal dust to accumulate at dangerous levels. They had been cited for that multiple times, and they continued rolling the dice, right, on someone else's lives. Only a few of us are old enough, from what I can see of the audience, to remember the Ford Pinto taken out of production. It was taken out of production partly because there was a significant rollover problem with the Pinto. Under certain conditions, it would just turn over, right? And we know that executives inside Ford Foundation, when they found that out, had a series of meetings about the cost-benefit issues. Is it going to cost us more money to take this thing out of production and fix it, or is it going to cost us more money to settle a predictable amount of lawsuits that will come from this, right? People sat in, and this, that's not the only case where this has happened, right? People did that kind of cost-benefit analysis around something where the moral issues would seem to be overwhelmingly clear. It would seem that there was no question. I don't know the history of the Enron scandal that well, but it would seem to me that there, too, some very, very privileged people were making decisions that they knew were going to impoverish innocents, right? And they went right ahead. And they did that. For those of us of a certain age, you cannot forget the thalidomide scandal, right? In which a drug company selling that sedative thalidomide found out that it was causing birth defects, and they went right on selling it. And it was, again, the same story as Ford. Let's stonewall this out, and let's pay the lawsuits that we have to pay. These are examples of completely immoral behavior, right? And as I was saying, my friend has spent quite a bit of time studying this kind of behavior and studying specifically some of those particular histories. The bad news is that Jackal finds that there is no reason, he can find no grounds for arguing that these immoral actions are fundamentally the behavior of immoral people. So far as he can see, these are people you would be happy to have teaching your Sunday school. That in most of their lives, they are upstanding, often thoughtful, often concerned citizens. But in some parts of their lives, he creates this language, right? What they do is bracket their morality, right? They draw brackets around their morality and say that in this part of what I have to do, those basic moral precepts don't matter. And then he goes through a long explanation of how people can come, how good people can come to do completely heinous things. But the part of it that I want to focus on for the purposes of this discussion is that a lot of it has to do with alienation. A lot of it has to do with people thinking that what they do doesn't matter, right? And that for the executives that he's talking about, people that we think of as privileged and powerful, they don't necessarily think of themselves that way in the context of these discussions, right? The language that they use repeatedly is, I'm a cog. I'm a part of a larger machine. And you can take the cog out. The machine's going to do what the machine's going to do, right? So I can say I will not support the selling of a product that's dangerous. And what that means is I'm going to lose my job. My subordinate, who's willing to support to go along with the program, gets my job. And the process goes right on. What I do does not matter, right? so long as there are so many other people willing to do what I'm doing. And another version of that is for people to just focus on having a very little part to play in a much longer, more complicated process. So that there was I shouldn't say the corporation if I'm not sure. One of the aeronautics corporations had this issue in which they were designing brakes for planes, putting brakes on planes that were clearly badly designed. And so in the investigation, somebody goes back to the engineers who are part of this process, and they say, hey, look, we're engineers, right? We design graphs and charts, and we send them to the boss. Now, what the bosses do with that stuff, we don't know, right? But they sort of refuse to focus on the possibility of their own culpability because they were in this larger institutional context which was going to do what it was going to do. Everybody claims what I do doesn't matter. And again, it's ironic that we're talking about, in some cases, that some of the kinds of people that we would ordinarily think of as the most powerful in our society. To go back to the professors and gangbangers comparison, it's interesting what happens when you go to the other end of the social scale and you ask gang leaders in cities like Chicago, how can they support the violence that's destroying their own community? The violence that they're unleashing endangers their own families, right? I mean, how can people do that, right? Ask drug dealers, how can you do this to your own community? You understand the consequences of this behavior, right? How can you do this, right? In my experience, overwhelmingly, the answer they give you is the same answer as those corporate executives. It doesn't matter whether I do it or not. I can get off this corner, I can stop selling these drugs, but see that guy over there? When I leave the corner, he's gonna take this corner over. The drugs will be here whether I'm here or not, right? The only difference will be then I'll be broke, that's all, right? But I am not the cause of the problem. I am, just as those corporate captains say, I'm just a cog in the machine, right? So I'm bringing this up in part to say that people we think of as very different, you know, our gangbangers, drug dealers, corporate leaders, at some level, when they're pushed into a corner to explain reprehensible behavior, they all resort to the same level of reasoning, or non-reasoning, if you will, right? They resort to the same kinds of self-serving agency. But I'm also trying to say something different that takes us back to social movements, right? To the degree that social movements focus on individual empowerment, to the degree that they focus on making people feel they have a right to a decision, to a voice in the decisions that affect their lives, to the degree that it makes them feel that they can matter, that they too can be historical actors. To that degree, social movements are operating in ways which undermine the kind of amorality that we have been talking about. Yeah. I've said that so many of the people that I know who are in the movement refer to it as the best moment in their lives. And it's not because they made history, it's not because laws were passed. They're talking almost always about the context of their own growth. In the context of trying to make the world better, they found their best and truest selves. And when we remember the movement, we should remember it in context, and we should remember it as a thing that made people stronger. Right? So I will stop with that. And we're gonna take questions. What happens next? Thank you.
For the cultural and religious pluralism today, building My bad.
The last few remarks that Professor Payne made, he talked about how the movement participants spoke about how meaningful that time was in their lives. And it reminded me of the remarks made by Miss Diane Nash, who was a very important person in the civil rights movement when she visited Salt Lake City. This woman, I fell in love with her as a young man because I read about her in Jet Magazine and Ebony Magazine and what she was doing. And she came to participate on a panel called Women in the Civil Rights Movement. And in the aftermath of having spent a couple of days with her, and I've thought about this at length, for her, it was almost as though she was in a time warp. She still viewed that period of time in which she was involved in the civil rights movement as the most important and defining movement time in her life. And in some way, she had never moved beyond that. And so I found that connection very, very interesting. Dr. Payne has agreed to take some questions from you all in the audience. So if you will stand up, and maybe my job is to be the runner to try to get the mic. Oh, we've got a co-runner to you. And we have some people in the back. Would you stand up, please, and maybe identify yourself, and then we'll pass it on.
Can I say something before we start with the questions? The mentioning of Diane Nash just started me thinking, right? About this, the complexity of this whole issue of empowerment, right? I'll say three things about her quickly, right? She could have been the president of SNCC. She could have run SNCC. She had that much respect in the organization. She came out of the Nashville student movement, which before the sit-in started, were planning to do Gandhian type civil disobedience in the civil and the city of Nashville. They were deeply, seriously into the study of Gandhi, much more so than Dr. King was at a comparable point in time. She is one of the truest, deepest proponents of nonviolence, which most folk in the movement in that period accepted as a kind of tactic, but not as a deep philosophy. For her, it was a deep philosophy, and just absolute physical courage, right? When the Freedom Rides are stopped because a mob attacks, I believe, burns the bus of Freedom Riders in Mississippi, Alabama, thank you. It is Diane Nash who makes the decision. You cannot give in to violence, right? Because if the perpetuators of violence see that it stops you, then that's all you're going to do is deal with violence, right? So she decides to get a group of students together. And in this incredibly tense and dangerous situation, they go into Montgomery, if memory serves, and they get another bus, and they continue the Freedom Rides, because Cole was actually willing to call them off, right? I'm just trying to convey a sense of a person of the deepest philosophical commitment, and that's probably the important part. Now, questions, please.
It was an online article it was an interview. I guess they were talking about the upcoming symposium, and there was an article about the exhibit, This Light of Ours. Mm-hmm. And when I never actually read an article online, but it was sent to me, and the comments that people could blog on these, you know, when you have an online interview, that were kind of disturbing, because what the people were reacting to when somebody was just, the newspaper reporter, Brian Maffley, was talking about the upcoming symposium and the exhibit, and the few comments that were on there were like, who cares about this? This was the past. Why don't we let things go? What do we need all this? You know, the 60s is over. It was very disturbing, but I'm just wondering, how do you address that? You know, how do you say, well, it's not just over?
Well, you know, the people who are blogging are people who have the time to blog, right? That probably tells you something about their lives. That's a cheap shot. I take that back. The idea that we should let the past be the past, that we should not stir up things, especially which could create controversy and trouble in the present. And I mean, it's fairly common. I remember once we were trying to get this, I forgot how this happened, but the schools of Indianola, Mississippi, in the middle of the Delta, to teach the civil rights movement, because it happened right there, right? And all these richness of resources. And we're trying to begin to, brought some people in to work with teachers. And a fair number of the teachers said, we don't want to revisit that painful history. Just let it be. I have occasionally, when I've been doing this kind of teaching with students, I've occasionally gotten that kind of reaction from Black parents. They're a handful, they're not representative, but that idea that the past we need to let go, that exists among Black parents too. My own response is partly Orwell's, I don't know if I can say it exactly right, who controls the present, controls the past. But he also said it works in reverse. By our images of the past are gonna shape what's possible for us in the present. And to the degree that we are unwilling, and this again goes back to comments that were made in different forms several times in the previous panel, to the degree that we are unwilling to face the tough things, the ugly things, the uncomfortable things in our past, I think you can feel absolutely certain we're not going to resolve those things in the present. You're putting Band-Aids over issues that are real. And remember, who was it, Faulkner? The past isn't past. The past isn't dead. It's not even really past yet, right? Those things continue to shape the possibilities of our lives. We have to understand them, so that's. But it is an attitude that I think we encounter quite a bit.
Hi, Professor. I'm here because my daughter that's a senior at Brighton High School came here because her teacher was giving them credit, the teacher's Hatfield. And I find that when kids given the opportunity, I had a nephew that was killed in the hazing. And given the opportunity to change things, they want to. It's the adults that are pretty apathetic, too busy, and it's money, the motivator. When you talk about Enron and all these things, bottom line is I feel that when you have a lot of money, it enables you to distance yourself. So what I would like to know is, as somebody who's an academic and an author, how do we inspire kids like my daughter to go into teaching, to start camps or to start symposiums like this? This should be packed. This is the most magnificent thing that I have been to in so long. It should be out the door. And everybody I look at in here, it should be standing room only. It's amazing. And as an entrepreneur and people who employ teenagers, would be willing to do anything to get kids and people my age involved again. Because I think we've all been so tired over the last 10 years with the war. I know I am. And broke and sick of paying for something that none of us agreed with. But they do have hope and they do believe. And her bringing me here today was one of the best things ever. So I would like to know what I can do or what you think we can do to help kids like her and teachers to continue to advise them to come to symposiums like this.
Woo, okay. You don't get another question today, I'll tell you that. No, it's a great question. Two things. Money can insulate people. That was the idea I got. I know your words were different. I just want to speak to that because that's a kind of in my room I'd say that's undialectical, young lady. Right? You got to be looking for contradictions in social phenomena, right? So if money has the capacity to insulate some people, it also has the capacity to inspire other people, right? And I can't do this as well as some friends of mine could, but if you understand, if you looked at the history of Jewish involvement in social movements in this country, right, it's hard, just because I happen to know this stuff, right, they are one-third of all the freedom riders in 1961 were Jewish. They're probably 2% of the national population at the time, right? Something's going on there, right? It's hard to think of a movement for inclusion and democracy in which Jews were not able to participate. And if you read the biographies of some of them are reacting partly to this long Jewish tradition of charity, which means that one serves God by serving others, right? I mean, that's a sophisticated way to think about charity. But also this notion that we are the privileged generation of Jews. We're not the poor Jews of two generations ago, right? And the mere fact that we are privileged gives us obligations and possibilities, right, that other folk don't have. So that's just to say that privilege, we're seeing this right now in the Black middle class, different parts of it reacting in very different ways to a level of privilege that we've never had in the Black community before. Right? So that's the part I can answer with confidence. The other about connecting the younger generation, I do spend a fair bit of time thinking about this. I think it's crucial to get the history taught. It is a history that, again, in my context, And I've done this last couple of years quite a bit of this teaching in high school. I've done a lot of it at the college level. That it's still possible when the history is taught. Let me say it this way: when it's taught with an edge, right? When it's taught as a critique, it's possible to have a very, very deep impact. Often when I do, I have various versions of the talk you just heard about the way in which we think of history isn't the way it happened, right? To be too simplistic about it. Students, I think, just because they're young and they're looking for something to disagree with, they actually buy into this notion, right? Hey, people have been lying to us about history. Well, what else are they lying to us about, right? I think the teaching of it has enormous potential. And the other thing that I'm just really, really sold on, and a lot of my time's going these days, putting young people in positions, this is pure SNCC, right? Put young people in positions of leadership and service right away. I've got a proposal I got to write tonight, as a matter of fact. And partly what I'm talking about is the impact on eighth graders when you let them tutor first and second graders in reading. And the kids who have the biggest impact are the bad eighth graders, the ones who don't do any work themselves, they're in trouble all the time. When you invest them with authority and responsibility and say, you don't let anybody pick on that kindergartner, and you make sure that kindergartner knows how to read in a couple of months, the impact can be very different when we look at them as a part of the solution right then and right now. But putting young people in those kinds of positions, which is the basic SNCC methodology, every cook can govern, I mean, that's clearly for me a part of it. Okay? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
I grew up in the Deep South watching everything up close. And it seems to me that at that time everything was really obvious. It was up front.
Can you say what time you're talking about, years?
I was born in 41, and So I graduated from high school in, 59? And my father was from Mississippi, so I have a long history of being really close to those problems. And in retrospect, the problems were so clear. I mean, it's just horrendous. But today, if you look at what the Koch brothers are doing and the bankers are doing, the contract defense people are doing, it's much more hidden. And I don't know if you see it that way, but if you do, what is the best way to go about this?
Let me give you a literary reference. I'm giving you the reference because I can't come up with a quote. It's Lorraine Hansberry's sign in Sidney Brustein's window, and it's actually a play about a Jewish activist, right? Finding his way back to activism. And there is a scene where he goes out to say, listen, when there was a problem among my ancestors, my ancestors in Israel, they strapped on a sword and they went out in the desert and they cut it down, right? And what he's trying to say is, now we are surrounded by 1,000 nameless vapors. It's not clear, right? How you can strike a vapor down. Trust me, Lorraine Hansberry says that a whole lot better than I just did. But take a look at that, sign in Sidney Brustein's window. That said, I think there are some differences. But people forget, and you actually said it in a very elegant way. You said in retrospect, those things seem clear. Because at the time, for the people going through it then, a lot of this is not clear. Let me see. 1963, June. Before Birmingham would have been going on, the civil rights, the 63 March hasn't happened. The first major civil rights bill of the 60s is more than a year away, right? Some of you young students, go look this up because I can't do this exactly right, but I'll be close. If you look at the Gallup poll from that June, the question is something like, are demonstrations hurting or helping the Negro cause? Remember now, it's only the Negro cause that's helped by demonstration. And the majority answer from the American public, by a quite wide majority, if my memory is right, 60 or 70% said it's hurting more than it's helping. We remember the movement as being a kind of a consensus movement. Americans basically agreed except for the crazy Southerners. It was not at the time. And remember that the response to much of the civil disobedience was, well, maybe you have an argument, but you're breaking the law by demonstrating. And breaking the law is wrong, irrespective of your goals. So let's sit down and talk, right? And the argument about public accommodations, well, what right do I have to sit at a hamburger counter if the person, at a lunch counter, if the person who owns it says they don't want people of my complexion? It's that person's business. They made that business. It's a private entity. I have no rights to interfere with the property rights of others. That's virtually quoting James J. Kilpatrick, who was a reporter someplace in, I think I want to say Richmond at the time. But a lot of other folk argued, right? So the things which seemed clear to us in retrospect were fuzzier then. And the people who stepped out got criticized in a way that I think we have forgotten then. And the other thing that I think that is dead clear, sociologists have a term about the rationalization of inequality by which they mean what you said, right? The processes by which inequality is produced are less personal. There's a plantation owner, there's a sheriff that's the source of the problem, and they're much more machine-like, right? It's the operation of an impersonal, faceless system. I think that there is some truth to that, right? But at the same time, what is still clear is the obvious maldistribution of privilege in the country, right? And so if you want to start the conversation at the level of what's causing inequality, that's a more complicated discussion now, I think, than it was in 1940. But if you start the conversation at the level of where are the unacceptable gaps in privilege in this country, boy, that's still pretty clear, right? So it's a great question and a complicated one. Please.
Hi. The first thing I'm going to say could be a little off the mark, so I may have to be corrected. Sorry. But my idea of feminism has always been associated with the upper class white woman. And I guess my question is, do you feel that black women, from what you saw or experienced, were so busy supporting the civil rights movement that they sort of missed getting involved in gender equality and being feminists?
Boy, are you talking about can't somebody ask a simple, straightforward question? I'm good on dates. Ask me something about with dates when something happened. That's complicated again. If you look at any of the polls from the 60s and 70s, they say that black women across class lines are more supportive of the feminist agenda than are white women, right? So the substance of feminism resonated very deeply with in black communities. When you talk to educated black women over a period of 20, maybe 30 years, feminism is something they associate, as you just did, with educated, I think the right language is self-serving white women, right? There's an ongoing dialogue, you know, I'm not deeply into this, but I know enough to know I'm describing it pretty well. Among the most politically acute black women, some of them, critiquing the racism inside the women's movement, right? I mean, so all of that is there. That said, there is also some truth. There was a period of time, I'm going to say it's middle to late 60s, in which, I'm hesitating because I'm not sure my language, so let me just blurt this out, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Black men in the movement use racial oppression to obscure gender oppression, right? And so one of the ways in which they did that, and a whole lots of games come off that one, right? But one of the ways in which they do that, which is, again, not to engage in stereotypes, but which was reinforced by some versions of nationalism, which were predicated on a conception of an imagined African past in which men were warriors, you know, play that out, right? And women had very defined and restricted roles, and some notion that that was the natural and historical arrangement for black people, right? I mean, arguments of various, imagine all the variety of ways that arguments of that can be shaped. So that there are attempts made to make black women feel guilty if they raise the issues of gender. There is some degree of success in that some of the brightest, toughest, most successful black organizers, women, step back from leadership roles, saying in various ways, it's time for the men to, you know, be men. Substitute your own rhetoric. The consequences of that for the African American movement were nothing short of disastrous. Taste of Power. Who wrote A Taste of Power? Elaine Brown. I think that her treatment of the gender dynamics of inside the Panther Party, to look at, you know, one of those formations, I think it's essentially accurate. And I think it's that when women had substantial leadership roles, the party was better organized, better respected, within and outside their programming was at a much higher level of quality. And when Huey Newton comes out of prison and the women in leadership positions are wiped out, right? Just like that, right? It begins what I think is fairly accurately described as a descent into some degrees of criminality, right? But certainly, there's no question that it descends into disorganization, right? And I think that's typical. When women were pushed out of leadership positions, either pushed out or opted out themselves because of this new men need to be in charge ideology, not new, actually, but because of the new prominence of that ideology, the consequences were just disastrous, right? When you take your best leaders and tell them they got to sit in the back of the room and take notes, right? And I use examples from the radical movement, but I could say the same thing for Southern Christian Leadership Conference, right? I mean, for the more centrist kinds of, it was just disastrous, black women being pushed out. Okay. Now I want an easy question. I'm tired of you people here. Oh, I'm sorry, the mic's over here.
I'm sorry, it's not. I'm chair of Utah Library Association Intellectual Freedom Committee, and we have been asked to defend a freedom of speech, freedom of the press issue by a group, and I'm not going to get into the entire reasons for them, but where a group of people in our state actually do not have civil rights, because they don't know about them, and it's been generations where they simply do not know that they have them. And maybe it's wishful thinking on my part, but I can't believe that our little group of people in our state far away are the only people in this entire country that are oppressed or do not know that we're living in, that they have this little isolation place in this country where civil rights have not reached us, where they still are oppressed, where women don't have rights, or where ignorance still applies. So this is what I want to know. Are there still places where we still need more education? We talked about why does it matter? And it's not that we just need to have the past apply, but we still need to have people educated because the present is still, that we still need to have people educated for the present. Is that just too obscure?
It's obscure now.
Should I tell them the group?
That was...
Do people know who I'm talking about? It's actually a group in southern Utah that have applied. They burned a bunch of books in the spring and stole their library and destroyed it. And it's the FLDS, it's a fundamentalist kind of group that broke off from the LDS church, and the women are much under the power of the man, and the group that's approached us were the ones that own the library. And the books that were burned, they confiscated the other ones. They're under lock and key. They can't get the books back. They've asked us to help get the books back. The women and children, many of them, and there's it's kind of controversial. They do not know that they don't have to answer to the man because the reading material was all destroyed in the town, and they can't get it, and they don't know there's any. And there's 10,000 people, and I just really, it's hard for me to believe that there's, it's this only isolated community. Maybe there's other little places in the country where people still need to know that they have rights.
It's not, I can't respond to a particular example, I just don't
but,
know.
But I, not this one, but I just wonder if there's, there's gotta be other ignorant
people.
Yeah,
but you're, if I'm following you, you're framing it too narrowly. The problem isn't the little groups of people who don't understand. It's the general population.
Right, that still need to be.
And I mean by that partly, we know that most Americans don't understand the Bill of Rights. We have just tons of data. Most folks do not understand. But if you ask people, are you in favor of the Bill of Rights? Everybody says yes. But if you then ask them to comment on any particular component of it, it's very clear people do not understand the basic rights which are enshrined in the American Constitution. That's at one level. And for me, as a person who works with young people in urban areas, some of the things which may be de facto in a case like that, or de facto within the regulations of a certain religious community, I'm sorry, which may, I've forgotten which, what means what, they may be de jure in a case like the one you're describing, that there's some official regulation. They exist de facto. I mean, the, most of the young black and Latino, many of the young black and Latino women with whom I come into contact in inner city Chicago cannot conceive of a life in which they don't define themselves by a man, right? And that makes them manipulable. It means that people who understand that can take advantage of them, right? That they have to give and they get nothing in return. So, I mean, that to put this, in, I guess, in the broadest way, the way I think of SNCC organizing is in part, how do you empower people? In part, you begin with the notion that people are disempowered by social exclusion, and you put them in networks and situations where they can get some of the kinds of experiences and information that the structures of their lives ordinarily make it impossible for them to have, right? So at that level, understanding of our collective rights and understanding of our larger possibilities beyond issues of rights, it's just an, it's fundamental. It's the reason I wrote that book. I'm sorry, I didn't like lecture on the book. It's the reason I wrote the first book I did on the civil rights movement.
Can we have one more question?
Yes, I'd like to thank you for coming this long distance and spending your time with us.
I've enjoyed it.
I want to share an observation that I think will provoke some comment. Today, the students of Chile are in the streets in Santiago and many other cities throughout the nation of Chile in protest over the existence of a class-segregated educational system. But they're also in the streets to remember the events of 9/11/1973, when a U.S.-led military coup blew away a long tradition of democracy in Chile and imposed a military dictatorship. And these students have great support among the population of the Chileans, largely because they feel their present government is starting to bring back shades of that former dictatorship. And I think it's a point of celebration that the National Student Organization is being led by a young, articulate woman. I thought these events interesting and could possibly provoke some comment by you. Thank you.
Well, yeah, lots of aspects of that to comment on. In a way, it takes us back to the first question, the question about why is it important to remember the past, let us say as accurately as we can, which means remembering the past through multiple perspectives. I don't think most Americans have any idea what you're talking about when you refer to the events of 73, right? And those who have heard of it may not necessarily accept the idea that America played a significant role in the overthrow of what was going to be a democratic, if socialist, kind of government. It seems to me that that's crucial for us to fuss through and to fight over and to put as many facts on the table in as many different contexts as possible. Because if you do that, then that changes the way in which you understand the way in which Chileans react to us now, how they understand us now, how they critique us now. But you can't have a substantial understanding of that if you are unaware of, unwilling to consider the history that they have lived through. So I'm glad you raised it, because it's something I think that on this day, it is good to remember in particular.
African-American people have been able to enjoy their version of the American dream. So it's basically the two sides of the same coin, and we owe as much to Dr. Martin Luther King and his peers as you are. So maybe you could elaborate on that point.
Well, can't elaborate much other than say I'm very glad that you made it, and that it, I think that's the kind of thing, the after decades of that my memory goes back to the 1920s. Leslie was telling me it goes back to the turn of the century. I meant to look this up and didn't. The overwhelming exclusion of Asian immigrants from this country in the context of the culture of equality that Dick Gregory, I think, accurately says is the civil rights movement helps to usher in, those kinds of things become less acceptable, right? Those kinds of exclusions. And so that now when I go to my little rural home in South Jersey, where I never saw any person of Asian descent growing up, right? Not for 20 years. It's just a very different world there now, right? I mean, folk that we would not have seen are present there. And to some degree, yeah, it's another example of civil rights movement. I actually play with the idea of whether we're not to even to try to squeeze in some kind of discussion about the impact of the civil rights movement abroad. My favorite example is actually the way in which the Irish Troubles, in which they very self-consciously came to the leadership of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, came to call that the Civil Rights Movement, very self-consciously in imitation of the American Civil Rights Movement, and that there's a period of time in the 1960s in which Irish leaders are consulting with Africa, in the 1950s and 60s actually, in which Irish leaders are consulting with American black leaders. So, thanks for raising that. Thank you.